Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Laura Soule.
And in today's episode, we're going to be taking a look at ostracods with Professor Dave Horn from Queen Mary University London. So this episode has been a real long time in coming. We've had Dave Horn on our list for, it must have been almost a year now. So we finally managed to get around to doing it, just as Laura and I both went to IPC4. So we're now back home. So did you enjoy the conference?
Yeah, I did. It was really good. Maybe listeners might have noticed that usually when I talk about conferences I go to, they're biology conferences. This one was full of paleontologists. Yay. So I got to meet all the people whose papers I read, and I knew people, which was a first. So that was fun. And I mean, Argentina is pretty awesome. So enjoyed the chance to go there and drink lots of wine and eat lots of steak. Did you enjoy it, Dave?
Well, yeah, it was pretty good. I can't really complain about being
such
out.
Enthusiasm.
Well, no, I spent most of, whilst everyone was busy listening to talks and stuff, I was running around like a headless chicken trying to get people to talk to us all.
Yeah, you did do a lot of editing, a lot of sitting by yourself in the bar.
Yeah. So we've got plenty more conferences to go to this year. So we're currently looking at going to SVP. And then we've got the usual Paleontological Association meeting, which is only in Leeds. So it's like the next town away from my hometown. So that's not too bad for me.
And SVP will be good for me because the V stands for vertebrate.
I'm not really too keen on the V bit, to be honest. I'd prefer an I.
S-I-P.
Yeah, invertebrate paleontology, that would be good.
Yeah, it wouldn't be as exciting though, would it?
Well, maybe not for our audience, but it would be for me. But still, right. it's a nice trip to Berlin. I don't think anyone can really complain with that.
No, I haven't been to Berlin before.
Ah, it's lovely. Yeah. Hello to all our German listeners.
Hello, German listeners.
Well, I might have to miss the conference actually, because it looks like I might be going to work again and looking at ostracods in real life on an oil rig.
Do you use ostracods for your oil stuff?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, every now and then. They can be very useful. So in the Barremian Hortorivian, which is the early Cretaceous, then they can be really, really useful. But otherwise, not so much. I mean, every now and then you get a nice ostracod that can really help you out of a sticky situation where you don't know quite what age your rocks are. But for the most part, ostracods are the really good environmental indicators, which we talk about in this episode. So I think that perhaps we should just get on with that instead of me telling you all about it, because I'm sure Dave will do a better job at that. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, if you like it, please share on social media and leave us a comment. We really love reading them. So with us now, we've got Dave Horn, who's Professor of Micropaleontology at Queen Mary University, London. So Dave, thanks for joining us. Could you tell us about yourself and how your research interests developed?
Well, I started out doing a degree in geology, and as part of that degree, I did a project involving looking at sediments, recent sediments in an estuary. And one day I looked at some of those sediments under the microscope and I saw lots of tiny little shells. And from that moment on, I got really interested in microfossils. So I then did a master's course at University College London in micropaleontology and got particularly interested in ostracods.
So now you're professor of micropaleontology. How did you end up getting that job?
Well, I've been doing research on ostracods since the late 1970s. Did my PhD at Bristol University on ostracods in the Severn Estuary. And since then, I've done research on fossil ostracods and living ostracods, both marine and non-marine, pretty much trying to cover as much of the geological record as I can and get experience of it. So I joined Queen Mary University of London about 10 years ago, and my research has been focusing on quaternary ostracods because I work here with other quaternary specialists. And I'm working with archaeologists in other places as well, looking at using ostracods to tell us about quaternary paleoenvironments and paleoclimates.
So that's really within the last kind of 2-3 million years, is it?
Yes, it's most of what I'm looking at in the quaternary is about the last 1 million years. We now have a good evidence of human occupation, early human occupation in Britain, stretching back to about 800,000 or 900,000 years, so almost 1 million years. And ostracods are telling us quite a lot about the context of that human occupation in Britain.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. So we've mentioned ostracods only a couple of times on PaleoCast, but only in passing. Could we therefore outline what they actually are?
Okay, so an ostracod is a tiny crustacean. They're related to crabs and shrimps and water fleas and things like that. And they're distinguished by having a shell that can be easily fossilized. So they have a fantastic fossil record from the Ordovician right up to the present day. Probably the best fossil record of any group of arthropods. If you imagine a shrimp encased in something that looks like a mussel shell, and the whole thing smaller than a grain of rice, that's pretty much what an ostracod looks like.
Yeah, I've always thought of them as looking like little pistachio nuts.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Or just a bit smaller.
With legs, yeah.
With legs sticking out, yeah. Yeah.
So they live in a near microbial world alongside many single-celled organisms such as foraminifera, and yet they're multicellular. Each of them has the organs, and each of those are made out of tissues and cells. So are the individual cells of ostracods just a lot smaller than normal, or are the single-celled organisms that they live beside relative giants?
I think it's more a case that the single-celled organisms, some of them have relatively large single cells. Ostracods and foraminifera tend to be of a very similar size, most of them. But if you put an ostracod alongside a typical foram, you've got a single-celled foram and you've got a metazoan ostracod, which is a pretty complex organism. But there are plenty of other very small metazoans. So I wouldn't say that ostracods have unusually small cells, no.
So what are the limits to how small an ostracod can be? What's the size range as well?
Well, the size range of adult ostracods is about 0.4 of a millimetre up to 2 or 3 millimetres. Maybe there are some freshwater ostracods that get pretty big. They're sort of giant size, up to 7 or 8 millimetres long. And there's one marine ostracod, a pelagic form living out in the oceanic waters, a thing called Gigantocypris. It's a good name. It's almost 3 centimetres across. So that's pretty huge for an ostracod.
I was going to say, is that the name that's almost 3 centimetres across?
The name's quite long as well. No, there are much longer names for ostracods, believe me. But most ostracods are in the range, in the adult stage, are in the range of sort of 0.5 millimetre to 1.5 millimetres long. That's fairly typical.
You said about the adult forms. So arthropods are well known for having exoskeletons and molting. Do ostracods go through the same process? Do they have instars, which are like growth stages before they molt?
Yes, ostracods have molt stages, instars. The typical ostracod hatches from the egg and goes through 8 molt stages before it reaches the adult stage. When they reach the adult stage, that's when they become fully mature and can reproduce. And after that, they pretty much don't molt again. So that's the end of the life cycle.
And so can you identify pedomorphic characteristics, or is it just based entirely on size? If we were to pick any ostracod up, could you say this is instar number 6 because it's got this feature, or do you just have to plot the size ranges on a graph and they kind of cluster together?
Well, the size range is probably the easiest way to do it if you have an assemblage and you can arrange them in order of size. But yes, you can see morphological features. The very first instar, when it hatches from the egg, usually has only two or three pairs of appendages. And with each molt, they maybe add a couple of appendages. The shell not only increases in size, but changes in shape. Most of the juveniles tend to be a bit more tapered, and then they sort of fill out at the back end when they reach sexual maturity in the adult stage. So there's an increase in number of appendages and development of the shell and the ornament of the shell and so on, up to some ostrogods have, the maximum is usually eight pairs of appendages in the adult stage. So yes, there are changes that you can identify. And when you're looking at a fossil assemblage, if you can identify the juveniles and you can assign them to different stages, that's very useful information because it can tell you something about the environment and the taphonomic processes that they've undergone before the assemblage ended up in the sediment or sedimentary rock.
Is that kind of things like size sorting?
Yeah, you get if you have a current of water or you have wave action, you will get size sorting. I mean, ostracod shells are just sand grains, essentially. So they will get sorted according to size and they will get transported. So if you culture ostracods, if you have them living in a jam jar or something like that, and they go through all of their molt stages, then the sediment in the bottom of that jar will have all of the instars represented by shells. But if you're in a natural environment and there's a bit of wave action to winnow out the smaller shells or a bit of current action to winnow out the smaller shells, then you may end up with a biased population age structure according to the different instar stages. So being able to read that in the record tells you something about the processes that assemblage has undergone. It tells you whether the assemblage you're looking at was actually formed in situ, in which case it's telling you something about that immediate environment, or if it is maybe a mixture of species that lived in a general area but have been transported and sorted and mixed, in which case it's telling you something more broadly about the range of environments that was available.
You mentioned the sexual maturity of the ostracods. We've had a little giggle about ostracod reproduction before on PaleoCast, but can you take us through what is quite a remarkable process for this group?
Well, ostracods are famous for having sex, but they're also famous for not having sex. The sexual ones, first of all, one group in particular, the Cypridoidean ostracods, which are the dominant ones in non-marine waters today, are famous for having very large spermatozoa. The sperm in the males of these ostracods can be several times longer than the animal itself. So if you have an ostracod 1 millimeter long, it might have sperm 3 or 4 millimeters long, and it has to keep them coiled up inside the shell. And then when it comes to time to reproduce, they have a pair of things called Zenker's organs, which are essentially muscular pumps that pump the sperm through when they're copulating with a female. So ostracods don't actually have the largest sperm in the animal kingdom, even in relation to body size. There are some insects that have larger sperm, but they are quite spectacular in that respect. And then there are asexual ostracods, possibly even more interesting, because there are some ostracods, the Darwinuloidean ostracods, for example, that seem to have reproduced without sex, simply by parthenogenesis, so you only find females. And they seem to have been doing that for maybe as long as 250 million years. And quite a lot of evolutionary theory says that shouldn't be possible. So there's been a lot of effort put into trying to work out what it is about Darwinuloidean ostracods that has enabled them to survive so long without sex, without genetic mixing that would help them to adapt to changing environments and so on. So I say that the Darwinuloidean ostracods reproduce without sex. They've actually been called ancient asexual scandals by some people because they're not supposed to be able to do this. We did find, a colleague of mine found three male specimens of one species on a Japanese island a few years ago. And we all got quite excited about that. It indicates that males can exist, but they are exceptionally rare. And what we still don't know is whether they're actually functional males or some sort of atavistic throwback to much older ancestry. So people get excited about Darwinuloidean ostracods.
I wish I could follow up with that with some biology and genetics, but I don't think I'm quite up with it all to do it justice. Well,
don't ask me about ostracod genetics. I do a lot of work with the geneticists, with the people doing the molecular biology of ostracods. I'm kind of the token paleontologist who helps them put what they're doing into the fossil record context, but I don't pretend to have a real understanding of the complexities of ostracod genetics. All I can say is it's a very rich and fascinating field of study.
So one of the diagnostic characteristics of the ostracods is that they have the shell. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of them having such a structure?
Okay, well, living inside a shell has advantages in that it protects you from the surrounding environment. It would help to protect you from predators, for example. I've watched beetle larvae trying to prey on some freshwater ostracods. We're talking about these sort of beetle larvae with big pincers on their heads, but they can't easily grab hold of an ostracod. It just slips out of their grasp like a slippery rugby ball, really. They are also advantageous in that if the environment goes a bit nasty temporarily, maybe it gets a bit too saline or there's not enough oxygen in the water, ostracods can seal themselves into their shells. They withdraw all of their appendages inside and they seal themselves up. And they can survive quite a long time like that. There's one example where somebody put a brackish water ostracod into some hypersaline water, very high salinity, and it sealed itself up and just sat there not moving. And a month later, he put it back into brackish water. And after a few hours, it opened up and started crawling around again, quite happy.
Wow.
So there are certainly survival advantages in having a shell. There are problems in having a shell as well, and one is the problem of respiration. It's essentially like, like living in a cupboard. You need a bit of air to get in. They need oxygenated water to get inside. So if you watch live ostracods, you can see them beating a pair of branchial plates, sort of feathery plates on some of the appendages that help to generate a current of water that passes through inside the shell, passing over the body surface where they can absorb oxygen. So they're adapted in that way to living inside this partly enclosed shell.
Aren't the properties of water different when you get down to such a small scale?
Yes, you're right. Water is quite a viscous medium for something the size of an ostracod. Which I suppose helps them when they're swimming and so on. They will not sink at such a fast rate, but they do have to kind of fight their way through the water a little bit by waving their appendages in order to swim. You can see this when you watch an ostracod, a living ostracod, under the microscope. I mentioned just now that they have to generate the current of water flowing inside the shell for respiration. And when you watch that current of water, you can see little particles in the water moving in through inside the shell. They don't move smoothly. It's not exactly a flow. You see them moving jerkily in time with the beating of the branchial plates. So the ostracod is literally pumping the water through. And there are some ostracods that filter feed. And again, at those sorts of scales, ostracods have to pump the water through their sieving appendages in order to filter feed and get the food particles out of the water.
So if we can talk a bit about their ecology now. We've covered a few of the different environments that they lived in. So you've mentioned freshwater, brackish and marine. Is that everywhere that they live?
Ostracods live, well, practically anywhere where there's water, and even some places where there's hardly any water. Yes, they live in marine conditions, in all depths of the sea, the oceans, shallow marine, around coral reefs, coastal waters, lagoons, estuaries, that kind of thing, brackish water. There are ostracods that live on salt marshes. And there are lots of non-marine ostracods, many of which, of course, are living in freshwater bodies like lakes, rivers, streams, springs, groundwater, shallow alluvial groundwater, caves, some living in temporary ponds, and some living in saline lakes as well, which is why we tend to talk about non-marine ostracods rather than simply freshwater ostracods. There are even some living in hot springs, and there are a few ostracods that are living in terrestrial or semi-terrestrial sort of environments amongst damp mosses, damp leaf litter in rainforests, that kind of thing.
Is it the case that ostracods are just incredibly resilient and can live anywhere that they choose? Or does each one of these environments have their own specialist ostracod?
Pretty much each one of these environments has its own adapted species. I mean, ostracods have been around a long time, 500 million years or so, since the early Ordovician. And different species have become adapted to a very wide range of environments. But most of them tend to be quite specific to particular environments. And of course, that's what makes them extremely useful in the fossil record, because if we can identify the different taxa, then we can work out what kind of paleoenvironments we're looking at.
Do we know how many species there are, or do we have to estimate?
We can estimate how many species. I think at the last count, it's been estimated there are probably around 20,000 species living today, of which only about half have been formally described. So there are still new species to be described and found. Probably in terms of the fossil record, I think something like 65,000 species have been described. So that's quite a lot, even if you allow for the fact that some might be synonyms of each other and so on. So there are plenty of them. They are extremely diverse.
Are there any problems with invasive species?
Yes, there are some examples. There are some exotic ostracods in Italian rice fields, for example, that have been imported with rice plants from Asia. There is at least one marine ostracod in British waters, which we know was imported with North American oysters. We don't really know if they're problematic or not, because we don't know enough about what these ostracods are actually doing. And I have a particular example that I'm getting very interested in of a terrestrial ostracod that lives on salt marshes, very high on salt marshes, and it's one of the few ostracods that I've ever seen that goes on moving even if it's out of water. It can crawl around in just slightly damp environments. It's an unusual group that was first described from the northwest Pacific, from the Kuril Islands. So quite what it's doing in Britain, we're not sure. We've got four localities in Britain now, and we're not sure whether it's an invader somehow brought in from the other side of the world, in which case it would be interesting to know, is it doing any harm? Should we be trying to eradicate it? Or is it possible that it's actually an endemic species that's been here all along? We've just never found it before because it lives in such an unusual place. And perhaps we should be trying to protect it and conserve it. It's an interesting conundrum for the conservationists, I think, and I don't have the answers yet.
Okay, so now that we've got a good understanding of the biology, I hope, can you explain to us how paleontologists are able to differentiate the different groups and species and groups in the fossil record? If you don't have, if you've only got the exuviae, you don't have any of the soft body. Is it all just morphological characteristics, a bump here, a little ridge there?
Yes, that's pretty much it. Mostly when you're looking at a fossil assemblage that you've washed out of a clay or a silt or a fine sand or something like that, you're looking at empty shells, and you can identify various features on those shells, like there are hinges along the dorsal margin, different hinge teeth and sockets that are interlocking so that the shell can be opened up and closed. There are marginal features. They have a sort of double thickness around the margin of the shell. They have pore canals carrying little sensory hairs that pass through the shell. All of these things have characteristic morphologies. Particularly useful are the muscle scar patterns. The pair of valves, the shell has adductor muscles that are used to close the shell when they want to seal themselves up tight. And those muscles are attached to the inside of the shells in a particular sort of central area. And there are characteristic muscle scar patterns that, if you can see those, you can identify the major group to the superfamily level, the major group of ostracod that you're looking at. So the Darwinuloidians that I mentioned earlier, for example, have a very characteristic sort of rosette pattern of adductor muscle scars. And then when you're trying to identify species, it's the details of the shape of the shell and the ornament. They can be pitted or spiny or reticulate. It's a whole range of different sort of shapes and ornaments that are available to ostracods. And you start looking at some very, very small differences sometimes to identify species.
If we're looking at such small details then and have a really good idea of the morphology of each shell, are we able to have a pretty high resolution record of their evolution? Do we understand all of the family relationships in the group?
We'd like to think that we understand them. Of course, we don't understand them well enough. One of the problems is, yes, you can identify species with quite a great deal of confidence in the fossil record, looking at all these fine details, but there is a lot of homeomorphy. Things have evolved to look similar, even if they're not actually very closely related. And particularly some of the work on some of the early Paleozoic ostracods, there are some remarkable finds of ostracods with preserved appendages. And this is a pretty rare thing. And some of the work on Silurian ostracods in particular with preserved appendages is suggesting to us that things that we might have classified one way according to their shells would actually be classified quite differently according to their appendages. So we've got to be a little bit wary when we're trying to work out these higher taxonomic relationships. Having said that, the fossil record is fantastic. It's the best fossil record of any group of arthropods. And when the molecular biologists, the geneticists are trying to establish relationships based on the modern ostracods, having some idea of how that would fit with the very long fossil record is, of course, extremely helpful.
So what kind of uses do ostracods have with such a rich fossil record?
Well, they're a very versatile group. They are useful, as are many other groups of fossils, in biostratigraphy. Different species have different vertical ranges through time, and you can establish zonation schemes just like people have done for macrofossils like ammonites and for other microfossils like foraminifera. In marine sediments, probably things like foraminifera are usually more abundant, so they tend to get used more for zonation, for determining the age of the sediments you're looking at. But when you get into brackish waters and especially into non-marine waters, that's where ostracods become extremely useful. And for example, in the Purbeck Wealden, the late Jurassic, early Cretaceous non-marine sequences of England, and there are, of course, similar basins all around the world of that sort of age, ostracods really come into their own, and they've been used for establishing zonation schemes in quite fine detail for correlations within basins and even attempts of correlations between basins. When it comes to paleoenvironmental analysis, ostracods are extremely valuable because they live in such a wide range of environments today. So they can tell us about past environments. We can identify different sorts of environments, whether we're looking at deep ocean or shallow continental shelf seas or coastal waters, lagoons and estuaries, or non-marine waters. And that's on a broad scale, but we can get a great deal of fine detail out of some ostracod assemblages. For example, when you look at non-marine ostracods, different species are adapted to different water chemistries, different solute chemistries in water. For example, some like sulfate-rich waters and some like carbonate-rich waters. And they can be very informative in assemblages recovered from lake sediments, for example, about the solute chemistry history of the particular water body that they were originally living in. And that can be interpreted in turn in terms of climatic changes. So they can really give us a tremendous amount of detail.
So ostracods are useful in working out dates of sediment and also the environments. Have you any case studies where these have been used?
One example that I worked on was from the Purbeck Wealden of England. And it was linked to the discovery of a dinosaur carcass or parts of a dinosaur carcass, which people from the Natural History Museum in London worked on. And we were able to establish that this iguanodon had actually died in a temporary pond because the ostracods that we found there were characteristic of temporary water bodies. rather than permanent water bodies. Just to explain, there are two particular groups of ostracods that you find in non-marine Purbeck-Wealden type of paleo environments. Some of them are ostracods that have brood care of the eggs and the early juvenile instars, and they can only live today in permanent water bodies. But there are other ostracods that have desiccation-resistant eggs, and that's an adaptation to living in temporary environments. And the ostracods that we found associated with this dinosaur were all of the second type. They're related to the ones that today have desiccation-resistant eggs. So it indicated that this was a temporary pond, probably a pool that was shrinking, and maybe the dinosaur got into it to try and get a drink and got bogged down in the mud and got stuck there. So being able to identify a temporary pond in the fossil record is actually quite special and quite unusual, because they tend not to leave much of a sedimentary record. There was a famous Norwegian crustacean expert, George Ossian Sars, in the late 19th and early 20th century, who used to grow ostracods from eggs cultivated from dried mud that was sent to him from various places like Africa and Australia and South America. And he would then describe the species that hatched out and reached maturity. These desiccation-resistant eggs, and sometimes they're also resistant to freezing, can be dispersed by natural means, in dried mud on the feet or on the feathers of birds migrating, for example, or simply blown by the wind. So it's a fantastic adaptation that's allowed ostracods to achieve extremely wide dispersal, for some species at least. And just to give you a nice example, a few years ago, a colleague and I were doing some field work on a Scottish island in the Outer Hebrides, and we found a very distinctive ostracod living in a freshwater rock pool on the coast, and we couldn't identify it at first. It eventually turned out to be a species originally described by the Norwegian SARS from southern Africa. It's also been recorded on coastal islands in the Baltic Sea off the coast of Finland. And its distribution, remarkably, seems to match the migration routes of a bird, the Arctic tern, which breeds in Scotland and Scandinavia, but migrates to the southern hemisphere for the southern hemisphere summer, does a round trip of something like 20,000 kilometres. We can't actually prove that the Arctic tern is transporting the ostracod eggs. It's just a very strong coincidence, which is quite compelling, I think. We did talk to an ornithologist about this, who told us that actually sightings of migrating terns are quite hard to verify, because looking through binoculars, it's very difficult to distinguish between an Arctic tern and a common tern. So they tend to record them as comic terns.
And with the, I think you mentioned your work with early humans.
My work with early humans, yes. I work with archaeologists who are studying the early human occupation of Britain. There's been a big project for about the last 12 years or so called AHOB, Ancient Human Occupation of Britain. So I've got involved with working with people who look at the various fossils that come out of these archaeological digs. And the ostracods are helpful in these sorts of settings for telling us, first of all, what the environment was like. And what people are particularly interested in is what the climate was like. So I have a method that I've developed called the Mutual Ostracod Temperature Range Method, or MOTR method for short, M-O-T-R. And that is a way of, first of all, calibrating living ostracod distributions in terms of their climate ranges. And we particularly look at January and July mean temperatures. And then we can apply that to a fossil assemblage and see what kind of temperature range that assemblage could have been living in. And that's very informative for the archaeologists, because they're looking at humans at the northern edge of their distribution and what kind of climate they had to adapt to, what they had to cope with. For example, if they were having to cope with pretty severe winters, then that implies that they must have had some sort of adaptations, perhaps the use of fire, perhaps clothing, shelters, and so on, to help them cope with those severe winters. So I'm playing a very minor, but I think useful role in filling out the kind of picture that we see of how these humans were living.
So if we can look at the evolution of the ostracods, we'll go right back to the Ordovician, around just less than 500 million years ago. The first ostracods, were they marine?
The earliest ostracods that we know were marine and living in shallow shelf seas. There are probably Cambrian ostracods, but we're not sure about them at the moment. There are two groups in the Cambrian called the Phosphatocopids and the Bradoreids, which were once thought to be ostracods because they're basically small bivalve shelled organisms. But when people started finding rare fossils with appendages preserved, it became very apparent that these were not ostracods, but other groups of arthropods that happened to have small bivalve shells. But somewhere amongst those, there may well be true ostracods in the Cambrian. We just haven't identified them for sure yet. There ought to be, because when you start in the Ordovician, representatives of practically all of the modern groups are already there. So they must have some sort of history before that, because we seem to be looking at a kind of explosion of ostracod diversity in the early Ordovician at the moment.
So did they explode into all the available niches that we see them in today?
What you have in the Ordovician is representatives of all of the major taxonomic groups today, but they're initially they're all living in marine environments. And then gradually through geological time, through the record, we see them diversifying into a wider range of environments. So sometime in the Silurian, some ostracods started to get off the bottom of the sea and move up into the water column, becoming planktonic or pelagic ostracods. Probably sometime in the early Carboniferous, some people would say perhaps as early as the Devonian, ostracods start to get into non-marine environments. So by the time you're into the Carboniferous and the Permian, you have quite a range of non-marine ostracods. And then moving through into the Mesozoic, well, actually, just to backtrack, if at the end of the Permian, with the mass extinction at the end of the Permian, that affected a lot of ostracods as well. So you have a whole new fauna beginning to develop in the Mesozoic. And it's then in the mid-Mesozoic, in the latest Jurassic and early Cretaceous, that's when you see a really big explosion of diversity in non-marine environments. And that's the Purbeck-Wealden sorts of paleoenvironments that I was talking about earlier. So there's this tremendous diversity that we see today has evolved in various stages throughout geological history.
So what would you say to try and sell ostracods to the general public?
That they are an extremely fascinating and diverse group. They have interesting evolution, interesting behavior. They live in a wide range of environments. They're very, very useful for a whole range of reasons, telling us about the age of deposits, about the environments of deposition, about past climates and so on. But the reason why I study them is because I like them. They're fascinating.
Well, Dave, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
An SVP will be good for me because the V stands for vertebrate.
Yeah, so I'm not too keen on P, to be honest.
On P?
Yeah.
No,
I prefer it. Oh, no, I like P.
I hope you like P because you're doing a PhD in it.
Oh dear, I lost myself in the metaphor there.
In spelling, that's what you lost yourself.